58% of voters in California passed Proposition 47 last November, but it seems that we didn't entirely know what we were saying yes or no to, and now lawmakers are trying to iron out some of what's being called the unintended consequences. Today on Insight, we're going to talk with former Senate President Pro Tem Daryl Steinberg and the director of the Center for California Studies, Steve Boilard. What about these glitches in the California initiative process? That's coming up, plus music from the United States Air Force Concert Band and the Singing Sergeants. These groups are in the area for their final concerts in a Western tour. We'll speak with the commander and conductor, Colonel Larry Lang. And on Sunday in Sacramento, a step back in time to the 20s and 30s, an event called West End Cabaret. We'll speak with Harley White Jr., Chef Adam Peckel, and historian Bill Berg. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. First, the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. If you voted yes for Prop 47 in the last election, you probably thought of it as a new sentencing law for California, a law that was going to knock some felonies down to misdemeanor status and then direct any money that was saved to a safe neighborhood and schools fund. Okay, do you ever recall hearing that Prop 47 would also change the collection of DNA samples, or that possession laws for date rape drugs would change? Those are some of what is being called the unintended consequence of the initiative process. And ironing out these issues right now is not an easy process itself. So in the studio with me to talk about this, former senator and president pro tem of the Senate, Daryl Steinberg, who is now a partner in the law firm Greenberg Traurig.
Good to have you back in the studio. Thank you.
Also, the director of the Center for California Studies at CSUS, Steve Boilard. And Steve also spent 14 years in the Legislative Analyst's Office. Steve,
good morning.
To have you back as well.
Thank you.
So I will start with you, Mr. Steinberg. Where was the language in Prop 47 that would have told us about DNA samples or date rape drug changes?
Well, let's take the DNA issue for example. First of all, I want to agree with the general premise that the initiative process needs to be much more closely aligned with the legislative process. And we'll talk later, I know, about a bill I authored in 2014 that helps bring them closer together.
Right.
But in this instance, I must say, I think there's a little bit of Monday morning politics here. Because take the DNA issue, for example. The current law says that felonies are subject to DNA testing, misdemeanors or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the critics of Prop 47 are saying, oh, my God, all of a sudden some of these new misdemeanors are not subject to DNA testing. But do you know what they're not including that are already misdemeanors not subject to the DNA requirement? Child endangerment, animal neglect, battery, domestic battery, drunk driving. And so it's a little bit of cherry picking here to say that, well, now drug possession is not subject to DNA because it's a misdemeanor. Well, there are a lot of misdemeanors that are actually more serious, not subject to DNA. So, again, there's a little bit of politicking going on, but the general premise, I think, is correct. There needs to be, I think, more legislative oversight and more information from the very beginning of these
initiatives.
I think
you just said a lot in a very short amount of time.
Sorry.
And I want to be sure that I understand what you're saying, because the Sacramento County DA, Anne Marie Schubert, was the one that sent out the warning on this. And she actually spoke to Assemblyman Jim Cooper saying, there are all these DNA samples that have already been collected from felons. And now with the change in laws, people who might have been felony, at least arrests, and had collections are all now perhaps exempt or at least can be challenged from being put into the DNA database.
Right. And I have great regard for our new DA. I think she's doing a great job. But on this one, we just plain disagree. She was an opponent to Prop 47. And so she's saying, oh, my God, now you can't collect DNA samples for drug possession, for example. True. But you've never, the law has always said that for misdemeanors, we don't collect DNA samples. And the existing misdemeanors are much more serious. Reckless driving, child endangerment, animal neglect, battery. And as I understand it, Assemblyman Cooper's bill, which would now reinstate the DNA requirement for Prop 47 crimes, does not include these other misdemeanors. So it's a little bit of politicking, the fact that law enforcement largely opposed Prop 47. And now, after the voters passed it pretty overwhelmingly, they're trying to chip away at it.
Well, Steve, what we're speaking to is, what do we know about what we're voting on? How are we supposed to know some of these details? We get a 100-word blurb, a summary about what the bill
well,
is?
Well, you are given that, but you technically you're given the entire statutory change as well. I mean, the voter pamphlet includes all the language that's going to go in. What you don't see, and this is probably a really good example, what you don't see is there wasn't any change, and I think this is Senator Steinberg's point, there wasn't any change in the DNA law, which already pre-exists, which says that DNA is not collected for misdemeanors. People just need to connect those dots. We're going to move some things from felonies to misdemeanors, and those that will result in different treatment of people at the misdemeanor level, including you don't have the DNA evidence collected. So what this really requires is that the people spend some time looking at the law, understanding what it means, analyze what it means, turning to experts for that. That 100 words cannot possibly convey all of the implications of that initiative change. So I think this is the shortcoming of the initiative process, that it requires voters to do a lot of extra research and work that normally would be done by the legislature when a bill moves through the legislative
process.
Doesn't
Prop 47, though, open the situation of a lawyer on behalf of his or her client contesting DNA collection in a misdemeanor charge because of Prop 47, even with the other law that you just cited, Steve?
I'm not quite following the question.
So you said there is state law in place regarding DNA sample collection.
Right, that it applies to felonies and not to misdemeanors.
And then we've got Prop 47 language, which has made it cloudy enough that even George Skelton, in a column in the LA Times last week, started with this sentence: all of us must have been snoring when Prop 47 passed.
Right, but I guess what I would, the way I read Skelton's argument is, it's not ambiguity in the law, it is just that we as voters didn't, again, connect the dots and pay attention to what exactly that would mean.
There's a larger point here, if I may, and that is that while the initiative process undoubtedly has its flaws, and there are a lot of people who are critical of it, the people do not want to change it dramatically. They like it. And oftentimes, the initiative is in response to the legislature over a long period of time not addressing a serious public policy issue. I know from my time in the legislature, there were numerous instances where members tried sentencing reform to differentiate between people who need to be in prison because they've committed violent crimes, and the huge expense to the taxpayers from keeping people locked up for long periods of time who didn't commit violent crimes, and a federal court telling us that our prisons are overcrowded. The legislature never dealt with sentencing reform because it was too hot. So the initiative process and the people step in, and sometimes they're ahead of the legislature. And I think that's an instance here where the two forces of power hopefully can work together to come to a good result. But the initiative doesn't always happen by accident. It happens because the public is saying, we want some change that representative government may not be ready to actually accomplish.
Some initiatives are very easy to understand and the language is simple. This one happens to be very long and complicated. And as we're talking about one aspect of it, there is at the same time another aspect of Prop 47 that's been challenged. And to your point, this is not at all the majority of the language. It's not the overarching intent or picture of it. But we've got this possession issue with date rape drugs, and that has prompted another piece of legislation to, is fix the right word, Steve? Fix an initiative?
Well, again, I think we're trying to second guess what the voters were thinking when they approved this legislation. That, you know, now, again, using Senator Steinberg's term, Monday morning quarterbacking, a lot of people are kind of questioning, did we really mean to exclude these drugs? Maybe some people did, maybe some people didn't.
Do you think people knew?
I think your average voter probably was not aware of the full list of laws that were going to be changed.
And let me pause you right there a minute. Does some of this fall on the Attorney General Kamala Harris? Does it come out of her office, since her office creates some of the language that tells the voters about an initiative?
I think it's on the opponents of the initiative to be real clear in the campaign what they believe the implications of the initiative are. I didn't hear these arguments, and maybe they were made, but I didn't hear them. They certainly weren't in the Sacramento Bee or on the public radio during the campaign itself. And so, you know, this is after the fact. Now, having said that, there's no reason why the legislature should not look at some of these issues, to look to see if some of these fixes might be made without having to go back to the ballot. I mean, reason needs to prevail here. But the voters overwhelmingly said, we want sentencing reform. We don't want nonviolent people in prison at $50,000, $60,000 a year getting out and being recidivists because they didn't get the mental health or substance abuse treatment that they needed while in prison. That's the big message here.
And I think, Beth, you make a real good point that there's a difference between a fairly simple initiative, and I think of like Prop 22. It's a very divisive initiative, but it was 14 words, and people can pretty easily take a side on, do you support same-sex marriage or not? And that was a fairly, again, it was a plebiscite on that question. This initiative is much more complicated, and I think I think it's unreasonable to expect the AG to be able to ensure that every voter understands all the pieces of this very complicated initiative.
There's irony in what Daryl Steinberg just said, isn't there, Steve? Because when the California initiative process was first created, which I think goes back
1911.
Some years. Thank you. The whole goal of it was to create an avenue away from the legislature and not have lawmakers involved, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's a safety valve where the people can go directly to create law themselves or amend the Constitution for that matter, rather if they feel like the legislature is not doing its job. And at the time, 1911, the legislature was largely captured by special interests, Southern Pacific Railroad. So it was seen as a safety valve, and I think not as a regular go-to alternative to the legislative process.
So now what we're doing is coming back around full circle. And Daryl, your legislation last year and the thrust of this kind of a conversation is that maybe there needs to be some balance, some voice on the part of lawmakers in the legislature in the process.
No question about it. What you really have, again, are two sources of power, representative government and the people's initiative. And too often, they are on parallel paths and they don't come together. And what my legislation did in 2014, 1253, is sought to bring them together. Currently under the process, once an initiative proponent files their signatures, which is generally 9 or 10 months before the election, it's game over. They can't remove the initiative. And so even if it's found to be flawed, even if the legislature has come up with the initiative proponent with a better solution, the initiative goes forward. My law changes that. Now the law will be beginning in 2016 that the initiative proponent and the representative government can agree after the signatures are submitted to withdraw the initiative from the ballot. It's the initiative proponent, though, who holds the card, so the legislature can't make them take it off. But with an agreement, the initiative can come off the ballot and be replaced by a compromise that has been worked out by the legislature and the executive branch of government. That is a huge change because it will allow the pressure of a potential initiative to be resolved not in the courts or after the fact, but by representative government in the same legislative session that the initiative has been filed for, the election period that the initiative has been filed for. I think that will make the two sources of power work closer together and will result in a better outcome for the people.
You're listening to Daryl Steinberg. You might recognize that voice. You might also recognize Steve Boylard's voice. We're talking about the unintended consequences of the California initiative process. The legislature and the governor did not take a stand, if I remember right, on Prop 47. They stayed removed. If 1253 had been in place in the vetting and early process of Prop 47, what might have happened?
Well, I think at a minimum, some of these controversies would have been more likely brought to public light, and they could have been discussed, And again, I don't agree with the DNA criticism, for example, because as it turns out, we already make distinctions in the law, and we don't test misdemeanors. We don't test DNA for misdemeanors, which include more serious crimes than some covered under Prop 47, but at least it would have been brought to light and could have been discussed and resolved. And if the legislature had decided to work with the initiative proponent and try to at least clarify those points and maybe go in the direction of some of the opponents when it comes to some of the other controversies, the initiative either could have gone off the ballot or could have been amended in some way and put on the ballot by the legislature. It might have resulted in an even better product than what the voters voted upon.
We are in an interesting situation now, though, because this discussion of DNA has come up to the surface. It's being talked about across the state. If some piece of legislation isn't passed, is there a public perception that may kind of ripple outward that, oh, DNA collection and DNA analysis has definitely weakened in the state of California?
I think there's a very simple legislative solution to this, and that is if the legislature wants to include more misdemeanors, including the Prop 47 misdemeanors for DNA collection, they can do that without going back to the people. Now, that's not free. One of the reasons why the legislature made that distinction is because of the cost to state government, the cost to local law enforcement agencies and the Department of Justice. It may be very well worth the cost, but that's a decision that the legislature can make without having to go back to the ballot and change what the voters' overall will in passing Proposition 47.
We've referred to this a couple times, so I just want to clarify the going back to the voters. When there is some sort of language that's a wrinkle in a proposition, there are a couple avenues for what can happen. And one is create an amended proposition or a counter proposition and get that back on the ballot.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I think it's important just to clarify this to the listeners that California's initiative process, by most accounts, is the most strict initiative process in the country. And that's because the legislature cannot amend directly any law that's passed by the voters through initiative. So the only recourse the legislature has, the legislature wanted to change Prop 47, some element of it, it would have to go back on the ballot and the voters would have to approve that again.
But this piece of legislation working its way through
is not an amendment directly to Prop 47.
No,
it's an amendment to the DNA law.
And it does require a two-thirds vote.
It does. Steve is right. Generally, you cannot amend the legislature cannot amend a proposition. Many propositions will have a provision that says so long as it's consistent with the initiative itself, the legislature can make clarifying amendments. And again, this DNA issue would be outside Prop 47 because all you're saying is that a range of misdemeanors should be covered by DNA. That's not inconsistent with Prop 47.
So I don't want to speculate on why the Sacramento County DA moved this discussion to where it is, but we do have two pieces of legislation at least. Do you know of any others that might attempt to deal with specific language?
Assemblymember Cooper's.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's three, one dealing with gun possession, one dealing with drug possession, and one dealing with DNA.
Okay. Prop 47 isn't the only poster child, if you will, for issues in the initiative process. And Steve, I'm sure you know of a few others.
Well, again, I think almost any controversial initiative is going to have its opponents who afterwards will say the voters did not understand what they were voting on. And there were efforts to amend. Well, Senator Steinberg's Prop 63 was a little bit, it's not exactly an unintended consequence, but there was an effort to go back and change how that money, you know, being able to tap into the funds that came from Prop 63, which was for mental health services. It was a case where here is the proponent of that legislation, who's the pro tem of the Senate, who can't lay his hands on that money without going back to the voters.
Although we found a way during the 2009 budget deficit, we found a way for Prop 63 to be helpful to alleviate the deficit because I wasn't going to allow it to be untouched while every other health
right.
and Human Services program was being
But didn't that go back onto the ballot as 1D or 1E? I can't remember.
That's correct. It did, and the voters rejected right. that part of it. But the initiative, this issue about the relationship between the initiative process and representative government goes beyond the Prop 47 controversy. You may remember in 2012 when the voters passed Proposition 30, which was the tax increase that that resulted in the state no longer being in deficit with all the cuts we made and the tax increase. We now have a budget surplus. People forget that at the time you had Molly Munger's initiative, the competing right. initiative. Right. You also had another organization that was trying to put essentially a millionaire's tax on the ballot to compete with Prop 30. They ended up working it out with the governor in the end, so there were only two initiatives. There could have been three competing initiatives. And if there had been three competing initiatives, without SB 1253, the bill we passed in 2014, there would have been no way to avoid three competing initiatives on the November 2012 ballot. Prop 30 might have failed. We might still be in deficit. If my law had been in place with three competing initiatives, there would have been then 9 months for the three initiative proponents to try to work it out.
But you're saying 30 might have gone down just because the vote would have been split up.
It would have been split. It was already split up among two, but it could have been a spoiler. And so the idea of being able to work it out, even after the signatures have been submitted, is a key change that I think will make the initiative process stronger and make representative government more responsive to the pressure from an initiative.
So before we end this conversation, let's look ahead then a little bit. You have a state constitutional amendment on the June ballot. And in 2016?
I do.
Don't you? No. Amendment 17 to allow the pay and benefits to be withheld from suspended legislators. People like Rod Wright and Lelin Yee and Ron Calderon.
This conversation was going so well. Back last year when I had to deal with these controversies, the Legislative Council told us very clearly that the state constitution prohibited us from suspending members without pay. And since I felt it was
So they all got in trouble and they continued
they
to be paid.
They all got in trouble, but I felt since they had not been convicted, at least Calderon and Yee, that it was unfair and violative due process to expel them before they had their due process. So we were stuck in the middle. And so it was what it was, but what we decided to do was put an amendment on the ballot in 2016 that says very clearly that the legislature can suspend its members without pay if they're accused of serious misconduct.
You know where I'm going with this, though. Did this pass through the 1253?
No. So, this preceded 1253.
I thought so.
Yes, it did. So, and I don't think anybody in the legislature this year is going to want to change that because it's a very common sense proposition, and I would predict confidently that the voters will pass it overwhelmingly.
We have one more on the November ballot in 2016, and that's the Multilingual Education Act. So would that one have passed through 1253?
That's a great question, since I believe that that 1253 would apply, even though it went on before 1253. It'd be an interesting, if it ever became a controversy, it would be an interesting case for the courts to decide. But my interpretation would be that, yes, any initiative on the November ballot for 2016 would have the benefit of the 1253 provisions.
Do you like the idea of where this is going, Steve?
Oh, very much
the
so.
Combination of legislature involved
Again, as we mentioned earlier, there's a reason we have an initiative process. I think it's an important safety valve to be in place. But the more that we can do to allow for compromise and a little more scrutiny and daylight on these initiatives, I think the better. I just emphasize one final point, which is you can get something on the ballot for $200. It's been $200 to file your own initiative since 1943. And you still need to collect 300,000 signatures or so, but you know, with paid signature gathering in a state of 38 million people, it's not that hard to do. So there's a fairly low threshold to get into this. And so the more we can do to try and resolve things without going to that initiative process, the better.
Thank you both. Good conversation.
Thank you so much, Beth.
I learned a lot. I always do when the two of you are together.
Well, so did I. So
thank you.
Thank you. That is Daryl Steinberg, the immediate past president pro tem of the California Senate, and Steve Boilar, the director of Sac State Center for California Studies. You can find more information, including quite a bit of coverage about the DNA issue in particular and the California initiative process, at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Jenny O'Mara is standing by with more news. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Beth. University of California President Janet Napolitano says she is capping non-resident enrollment at UC Berkeley and UCLA to address concerns that California students are being displaced. Napolitano told lawmakers during a budget hearing in Sacramento yesterday that the percentage of out-of-state and international undergraduates at the two popular campuses will not increase during the next academic year. Artists attended the Sacramento City Council meeting last night to speak against the plan to spend $8 million on a sculpture for the new downtown Sacramento arena. All 17 people who spoke were opposed to the Sacramento Metropolitan Arts Commission decision to obtain a colorful metallic piece to be named Piglet by New York artist Jeff Koons. Many questioned spending so much money on one piece of art. Others asked why Sacramento artists were not considered for the signature sculpture for the arena. Supporters of the commission's decision say Koons' popularity is an important factor in the decision to commission his work. And the Sacramento Kings have hired Vlade Divac as the team's vice president of basketball and franchise operations. He's a former player with the Kings, Lakers, and Charlotte. Divac's responsibilities include advising the Kings' front office and coaching staff, assisting the organization's global branding efforts, and oversight of player development programs. You can follow us on Twitter at Cap Radio News.
Yes, I wonder how many people said, oh, Vladdy's coming back. How great.
A very popular player.
Yeah,
yes.
Really terrific. Thanks, Jenny.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, and that is the music of the United States Air Force Concert Band, the premier musical organization of the United States Air Force. This week, you have a few opportunities to hear and see the band and the singing sergeants. Musicians arrived in the Reno area last night for two shows, and then there's a final stop on a tour that they're in the midst of Saturday in Fairfield. On the phone is Colonel Larry Lang, the commander and conductor of the United States Air Force Band from Washington, D.C. Colonel Lang, welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Beth. It's great to be with you.
So you're winding down what's nearly a two-week tour. How's the spirit in your, I'll call them road warriors?
You know, it's been fantastic, and a lot because the crowds have been just so wonderful. We've had almost full houses, if not over capacity, every night, and it's always inspiring to us to get out and see our communities across the country.
You've been doing this for a very long time. Did the audiences give you a gauge of the patriotism in our country? Is there something that you just personally for yourself can read?
You know, that's very interesting because I talk to the audience about that every night, you know, because as we listen to the news, it's often difficult to capture that patriotism. You often hear negative things about our military even, or the Air Force, or what's going on in our nation. But as we play, it's very evident to me, and I've been doing this, as you say, a long time, for 25 years now, that patriotism is alive and well. And our audience, they just respond so favorably to, you know, marches and patriotic favorites, but also to our efforts to honor our veterans, which we do every night as we play, and all of those who serve to protect this great nation of ours.
Is the purpose then broader than entertainment? Do you feel that you're doing more than just sharing music?
Absolutely. It's critically important, first, that we do honor those who have and are serving, because that's very important. We also want to communicate excellence, you know, and tell people about the kind of excellent work that airmen are doing all over the globe each and every day. We convey that through our music, through the way that we conduct ourselves on stage, through the way we play, and hopefully demonstrate some of that Air Force excellence. And of course, we just want to inspire patriotism too and encourage people to support the Air Force, the military, and our nation.
I understand that there are six different ensembles under the umbrella of the Air Force Band. So the two groups on this tour are the concert band and the singing sergeants. How many musicians is that?
It's about 80. Yeah, it's the concert band's 53 and the choir is 20 members. And then we have some audio technicians that come with us, of course, to make us sound good. And it's a great team. We started the tour separately because the chorus had a wonderful opportunity to perform at the American Choral Directors Association in Salt Lake City with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. And so we let them go separate for a day or two, and then we came back together and have performed several shows together, and we'll be performing there in Fairfield on Saturday together, as a matter of fact.
We're going to share a piece of music that was commissioned, a song called Departures. Is there a little more to the story about this music?
It was actually written by our senior Air Force composer, Robert Thurston, who has retired, and it was actually written because he was departing from the Air Force. So it was kind of his last piece. It's also about the departures that airmen make as they leave their families to go on deployments all over the world, you know, on different assignments. So it's his tribute to airmen and also kind of his farewell.
You're listening to the music of the U.S. Air Force Concert Band. The band with the singing sergeants is touring the West out of Washington, D.C. Tonight's concert, by the way, in Carson City is sold out, but there are two more shows, Friday at the Grand Sierra Resort and Casino in Reno, and I believe there are no tickets needed for that one. Then on Saturday, as Colonel Lang referenced, in Fairfield at the Rodriguez High School, there's a free concert at 7 p.m., and I'm speaking with Colonel Larry Lang, the commander and conductor. Did I get those details right?
You did. The show in Carson City tonight, although the tickets have been given out, there's usually, almost always, a handful of seats left. And so I encourage people, if they still would like to come, and they'll let anyone, even without a ticket, in at the last, in like the last 10 minutes. So we'd love to have them. And then the concert on Friday night is at the American Bandmasters Association. It's an academic setting, and the concert's a little bit different in its intent, but we'd love to have people come out if they can, and it's in the Summit Ballroom here at the Grand Sierra Hotel.
All right, we'll post information and details about all the different performances. Tell me a little bit about the Singing Sergeants.
Well, this is a group that was formed out of the band back in the late 1940s. The band is almost 75 years old. It was started in 1941. And, you know, as the band began, it became obvious that having a vocalist out front was very effective. And so more and more of the band members themselves began to sing. They formed a glee club of sorts with the men in the band. And then by the 1970s, they had, of course, a mixed chorus with females and males. And The chorus has performed for every president since President Eisenhower. They perform all over the National Capital Region for various functions, ceremonial events, distinguished visitors from all over the world hear the chorus. And, of course, they accompany the concert band as we travel. We always travel together. And they just put on such a great show. Of course, they're the part that people often love the most because they help us sing those patriotic favorites, and they also are featured. For example, on the shows we'll be doing this week, we have them featured on a Stephen Sondheim medley that ends with music from Into the Woods, which is now in theaters, of course, as a movie. But they connect, you know, the spoken and sung words connects very readily to people, so they're very, very effective at what they do.
We're going to hear a piece of music now, and the vocals will be the Singing Sergeants with the concert band in the accompaniment, and this is the U.S. Air Force Concert Band. Singing Sergeants, it must have been such a performance. I didn't see it, but in combination with Carrie Wood for the Concert for Valor broadcast?
Yes, Carrie Underwood invited the Singing Sergeants to sing along with her on one of her latest hits, and she's a real patriot herself and had seen and heard the Singing Sergeants at the Super Bowl last year. With Renee Fleming, and I thought it'd be just fantastic to include them in her own tribute to our troops serving all around the globe. So it was a very last-minute kind of thing. She called, I think, maybe 7 days before the actual event, and the sergeants showed up and rehearsed with her one time and then did the show together. So it was a lot of fun, and we do that kind of thing on a fairly regular basis with artists from all over the world. So Renee Fleming was in town recently, and we had some time with her as well. So we have a very active guest artist series, everything from opera to pop to jazz, you name it.
Do you ever pick up the trombone yourself?
I do from time to time. I was a professional trombone player before I came into the Air Force and spent many years performing in symphonies and jazz bands and for commercial work. And I've been in front of Air Force bands, kind of posing, if you will, as Glenn Miller, Major Glenn Miller. I was told a long time ago that I look a little bit like Glenn Miller, and so I got his uniform and a trombone that looks very much like his. I have his glasses, or glasses that look like his, and I can play his music pretty well, so every once in a while I'll get up and do the Glenn Miller music, which is always fun.
Well, now we have to make sure we've posted your picture. We'll find as much of a lookalike as we can come up with and put it on our website. I don't know how you move 80 musicians and support staff with all the instruments across the country in a big caravan, but it must be quite a scene as you're coming through.
It is. Folks will see three very, you know, coach buses with Air Force symbol right on them there if they come to our concert. Right out in front, they'll be parked in the parking lots, and then two semi-tractor trailers full of all of our gear. So, yep, it takes a lot to get us on the road, but we're very, very efficient. We do this a couple of times a year and have been doing it for, of course, almost 75 years. not only throughout the United States, but all over the world.
Well, Colonel Lang, thank you for this conversation, and thank you to you and everyone that works with you in the Air Force for your service to our country.
Beth, we appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and to highlight our concerts in your area. Thanks so very, very much to you and your audience.
Well, safe travels as you finish the tour. That, again, is Colonel Larry Lang, the commander and conductor of the U.S. Air Force Band. We have more information about the upcoming three performances with that first one tonight. It's all at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. Here's something fun and entertaining, and I think really different for the Sacramento region. Harley White Jr. was inspired to bring together his big band orchestra, some local history, his appreciation of great food, and probably more elements than I even know of, into a series called the West End Cabaret. The first event is this Sunday afternoon at the Spiritual Life Center, and I have guests in the studio who can probably help unroll what this event is about more than I can in detail. First, Harley White Jr., welcome.
Thank you.
Good
thank
to have you.
You
here.
Essentially, what it's about is a celebration of music and food. There was a Chinese philosopher named Lao Tzu, and he basically said, food and music are the two things that make people stop what they're doing and enjoy. And when I read that first time, maybe 20 years ago, I had to sit back and think about, you know, that. And yes, that was, and in my personal life, whatever I'm doing, food and music can pretty much make me stop and enjoy. It has that power. So
the emphasis of this event is the 20s and 30s. Chef Adam Peckel is working on a menu that will go along with it. But in terms of the entertainment and more of the flavor of those eras, Bill Berg, who is a Sacramento historian, and I think not only knows the history we all know, but some of the more colorful stories, will be sharing some entertainment. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
Tell me about your role in this event.
Well, Harley asked me to participate in showing off some of Sacramento's hidden history, the story of our lost neighborhood, the West End. People, when they think of downtown Sacramento, they always think of K Street, but K Street was flanked by an enormous population, an incredibly diverse neighborhood, primarily of immigrants, and the largest two portions of it in this era were Chinatown to the north of K and Japantown to the south of K. And this was a neighborhood that was large enough to be extraordinarily diverse, have its own businesses, its own entertainment, but not large enough for anyone to be independent of the rest of the city. So there was a huge amount of cultural crossing taking place. And wherever you have cultural crossings, whether it's with music or food, that's where jazz is born.
So orchestral blues was a sound of the streets in the West End neighborhoods?
The jazz, like I said, it's a multicultural form, and all of the people growing up here are Americans, and they're in love with American music. So you'd hear a wide variety of jazz with many, many influences. Many had been taught the traditional music of their community, but they heard music on the radio, so they blended the two, and they combined in new ways unseen anywhere else.
That's part of your point, isn't it, Harley?
That's exactly
that we were
my
all
point.
Here together.
Just being a jazz musician, and I've been saying this as I've been doing the research, it's like everybody was doing it. I mean, in the 20s and 30s, yeah, there was some resistance. For instance, Bill and I went and saw a film by a woman named Betty Anata, a Sacramentan, and it was shot in Japan. All the clothes were Western. They were all doing Western dances. And so for me, this was a jazz story, but it ended up being more of a humanity story because everybody was doing the cakewalk and all the latest dances and listening to the Victrolas and doing the foxtrots. So.
In fact, here's a piece of music from exactly the story you're telling. This is Take a Number from 1 to 10.
ましょうよ どんな声 こと思ってるか。あなたの心あまりに浮気で本当に困りものよ。From 1 to 10, double it and add a zillion. That's how many thrills I'll get. That's how many chills I'll get on the day when you will say, I do, I do, I do.
Wait, she was born in Sacramento?
Yes, she's
doesn't
a Sacramento
sound
native.
Like it.
Well,
native-born Sacramentan.
Well, she was a very versatile performer in a movie. She actually sings in like the three different languages. She hulas. And she tap dances.
Okay.
We're trying to bring the film back, actually.
And let's expand this conversation, because also in the studio is Paula Mandela. And Paula, you actually were involved years and years ago in bringing Count Basie to Sacramento.
It was only 2 years ago, actually.
Oh, it was just 2 years ago?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So tell me about your role in this event.
Well, to use a phrase that I got from Harley, I'm in this situation, I'm the spoon that's stirring the soup. So I've been serving as music director at the Spiritual Life Center for the last 9 years, and Harley and I have collaborated on many events. And this originally was going to be a part of a Black History Month event. It got pushed out to March. And then Harley unfolded his ideas about the food element and the history element. So,
and in this series, the goal is to move through eras of history, isn't it?
We're going to do the late 40s and post-war cuisine next. There's some talk of doing a show that's in the 1890s. And going through and finding the music and finding the players and I love what Bill does, because he tries to give you the feel of the era and the people and the players, so that you can have some reverence and some dimension to our presentation and real kinship with the people and what they went through.
So, William, tell me a little bit more about the show, about the actual entertainment that night.
Well, it's kind of going to be a jam session, in that it combines music and historic images and the storytelling about these Sacramentans. I like to use a magic lantern format, where I show historic images and talk about what's going on, but rather than more of the PowerPoint presentation where you're reading bullet points off a slide, I want to show people who these folks were, what the cultural world of Sacramento looked like in the 1920s and early 1930s. And it'll be interspersed with jazz of the era combined with a background of more historic images.
I said that the event time is Sunday at 1 o'clock. So, Paula, is it a lunch and then entertainment?
Well, the day actually starts with our services. We have two services at 9 and 11, and the Harley White Jr. Orchestra is going to present of the works of Duke Ellington's sacred works. And then we will serve lunch at 12:15, and then the program with the history and the jazz is at 1:30.
But you've made a commitment to stay together through all the eras of Sacramento's past to come up to present day, right?
Yes. I mean, I think if you understand the past.
You didn't say that very convincingly.
No. I'm saying, because there's a lot of work.
You just know what's ahead of you.
That's what you heard.
Yeah,
there's a lot of work, right. So that's what you heard. But, and hopefully to help Sacramentans get a better understanding of where we were and where we're going.
Right.
Also, to really, really take, we have this moniker with the most culturally diverse city. Well, let's move from the surface. Let's actually really be that. And what Bill was talking about, that really was kind of like this. I don't feel that we really know our history and appreciate ourselves as much as we should. And I will leave that there.
So it's a teachable moment. It's a teachable, entertaining moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but just sharing food and music is not deep. In that way.
Let's start some of the music we're going to close the show with. This is called Kung Fu Boogie, which is your orchestra.
And this is my orchestra.
And an original composition.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. And I don't know if you're going to perform that this Sunday, but we do.
Will.
You will.
Yeah.
We have a lot of information on our website, capradio.org/insight, about this event. The series is called the West End Cabaret, Sunday at 1 o'clock. Paula,
Thank you very much for joining us. That's Paula Mandela from the Spiritual Life Center. Also, William Berg, and he's going to share a little bit of magic, a lot of history, a lot of fun at the event. And, of course, Harley White Jr., great to have you all here.
Thank you, Beth.
Thanks for joining us, and that's Insight for today. Here's more music. I'm Beth Ruyak. Our senior producer is Jen Picard. Our producer is James Morrison. Our digital editor is Marnette Federis. We had help this morning from Cody Drabble. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our executive producer is Joe Barr. Thanks for joining us.